This show is created for adult audiences only. Our show notes include content warnings and other helpful information. We strongly recommend taking a moment to assess the situation before continuing. Let's begin.
Episode 43, The Mysterious Death of Olivia Maybell. It is often said that becoming a parent is one of the greatest joys that a human being can experience. An expansion of one's capacity for love and joy that is beyond description. Something that has to be experienced in order to be understood. As with any great emotional gain, this experience comes with incredible vulnerability. Parenthood is a beautiful privilege that can, unfortunately, be taken from you by the universe as quickly as it is bestowed upon you. And the flip side of that coin brings with it a level of psychological devastation that similarly could not be imagined. The loss of a child is without a doubt the most terrifying prospect floating in the mind of any young parent. To have the door opened on a deeper, more connected and joyful dimension of the world, only to have it slammed in your face, taken from you, is an event that many people never recover from. This level of loss often leaves the survivor feeling empty, isolated, and racked with guilt. Far too often, these losses lead to deep, lifelong depression that many find too heavy a burden to bear. Living in a reality inside their own minds, filled with memories unattainable, torturous reimaginings of the life and loss of their beloved child. For so many, this psychological devastation is beyond mending. It is an emotional prison with one perceivable escape: death. In the early spring of 1990, this terrible circumstance is exactly what befell a young family living in Salina, Texas. Following the birth of their son, Aiden, in 1983, Travis and Olivia Maybell had purchased the Footlights Ranch, a sprawling four-bedroom home on 15 acres of open Texas prairie land just north of Dallas. While the large property was purchased in hopes of expanding their young family, they spent those early years pouring all of their love and attention on their only son. On March 13, 1990, Olivia was approached by her 7-year-old son. As with many afternoons, Aiden's request to spend the remainder of the day running the massive property came even before the lunch dishes had been rinsed. As with most afternoons, Olivia approved the request with a beaming smile and a reminder to be back in time for dinner. He raced out the back door and she watched him run across the backyard and through the nearby tree line, celebrating the privilege all the way. She knew she wouldn't see or hear from him for the rest of the afternoon, and that was true. But dinner was ready around 5:30, and she still had not heard from him. By 6 p.m., Travis was home from work. Dinner sat cold on the table and Aiden was still unaccounted for. While this was not a regular occurrence, it wasn't unheard of for him to lose track of time, lost in some boyhood adventure. They assumed this was the case. To be honest, they were more annoyed than concerned, and they set off to find him. Nothing could have prepared them for how wrong they were. They retraced his path out the back door, across the backyard, and through the tree line. It was in a pond about 50 yards from that tree line. They found their son floating, face down. He had fallen in and drowned. Travis leaped into the water and swam to him, dragging him to the nearby bank. But devastatingly, he was beyond resuscitation. Travis and Olivia were destroyed. Sadly, as in many cases, their relationship simply was not strong enough to bear the terrible loss. Blame was cast on each other and themselves, an unavoidable result of such unmanageable and visceral guilt. Olivia's regular life soon fell by the wayside. Friends, family, church, and even Travis were soon forgotten. She rarely even left the house. And by the one-year anniversary of Aiden's death, the formerly content family had dissolved entirely. They divorced, and Travis pulled up stakes for Boston in hopes of putting the tragedy behind him. Olivia had the opposite reaction. She chose to stay there on the ranch. She lived alone, secluded, surrounded by nothing but the 15 acres of land that had taken her son. Aside from one quick sighting by a neighbor in the winter of 1991, no one ever saw Olivia again. Attempts to reach out to her were made over the years by family, including Travis, but phone calls and letters were ignored. Visitors to the ranch were greeted by the silence of what appeared to be an unoccupied dwelling. Groceries were ordered and delivered once a week, until December of 1993. Other than that, Olivia lived in complete seclusion from the outside world. There was no way for neighbors to know for sure if she was even still living there until February 27, 1994. The Salina Police Department received a 911 call.
911, what's your emergency? 911, what's your emergency? If you need police...
The dispatcher immediately went about tracing the call. But before the trace could be completed, another call came in.
911, what's your...
Same unnerving silence. Soon a third call came in just like the first two.
911,
and all three calls were traced back to the same address. The home of Olivia Maybell, the Footlights Ranch.
Car 36 responding.
When patrol arrived at the home, they found it to be locked up tight.
Open up!
Every window in the single-story ranch was painted over, and the front door had gone unused for so long that it was visibly swollen in the frame, rendering it useless. Convinced that this was something more than a series of unintentional calls, the police erred on the side of caution and forced entry into the desolate domicile. What awaited them inside was something that would be pondered over and debated in their department for the next 20 years. For all intents and purposes, the house appeared as though it had been abandoned years ago. A thick layer of dust covered everything. Heavily mildewed cobwebs hung from every hard edge in the home. As they made their way through the house, room after room looked completely undisturbed, let alone lived in. This was the case consistently throughout the 3,000 square feet of space, until they reached the room that had once belonged to the couple's deceased son, Aiden. This room stood in stark contrast to the rest of the house, looking exactly as it had 4 years ago. Toys put away in bins, books ordered from tallest to shortest on the shelf, stuffed animals lined up at the foot of a hastily made bed. Not a speck of dust, not a single cobweb. Centered in the room sat an oak rocking chair where they found Olivia Maybell. Nightgown, slippers, dead. Held tightly in her decaying hands was a small doll wrapped in the scraps of old clothing that bore a striking resemblance to her tragically lost son. Reports from the scene would later be confirmed by a coroner's report that found Olivia had been dead for at least 2 months. Sat directly in front of her was an altar built on top of an end table from the living room in honor of Aiden. Photos and drawings of him surrounded by still-lit candles, fresh flowers, and a handful of his most treasured possessions. Scattered throughout the altar were crumpled sheets of paper covered in carefully penned letters from a deeply grieving mother to her late son. While obviously distraught by this terrible scene, investigators couldn't help but ponder the obvious question. Who had made those 911 calls? The event was described thoroughly in a report filed by Officer Francesca Santiago, who was first on the scene. Other than the police entry point, there was no sign of forced entry. There was no sign that anyone had been inside the home in months. Each of the home's windows and doors was locked from the inside. The thick layer of dust found throughout the home included a heavy, undisturbed layer on the only telephone on the premises. The situation took an even more baffling turn upon inspection of the letters found on the altar. One letter in particular stated, quote, "My Aiden, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I should never have let it get like this. I'm leaving. I will not let you keep me, you vile, evil creature. Mommy's coming for you, Aiden. My sweet Aiden. Mommy loves you." What truly perplexed investigators was the fact that this letter was dated February 27th, 1994, the very day that they had discovered her, the very day that the 911 calls had been made. Deeper than a simple altar of reverence, a more thorough investigation showed that Olivia had been experimenting with occult rituals. Small note cards found scattered on the altar were covered in Sanskrit characters that were later found to spell "to build" or "construct." Many believe that Olivia had spent her final years attempting to construct a tulpa, a thought form, an easy theory to support when considering her obsession with her late son, her intense isolation, the altar, the doll found to mimic her son's appearance. Could she have found a way to channel her unbelievable grief into an entity bearing the appearance of her son? According to Tibetan Buddhism, and later 19th century theosophists who redefined the term, a being can be created through intense mental and spiritual discipline, a living concentration of thought and intention. One must consider the acute desperation and fierce regret of a grieving mother, the intense obsession with regaining that which was lost. It is important to understand here that, according to theories developed over centuries of study, if this being was created from this intense negativity, one could assume that it would reflect the negativity that powered its creation. Could this living embodiment of grief have gained enough power to gain autonomy? Could it have turned against its creator? Officer Francesca went on to note in her report that all the officers on the scene felt a powerful, aggressive presence. They were constantly troubled, emotional, and felt watched at all times within the home. In 1997, the home was purchased by Christopher Hagen for far below market value. He planned on renovating and flipping the large property. It has been on the market now for 25 years. Hagen says that any prospective buyer who has toured the house has been immediately turned away by the apparent oppressive energy. He himself has experienced a full range of paranormal occurrences since renovating the property. In 2005, paranormal investigator Drew Navarro visited the property to conduct an investigation. Following her time spent on the ranch, Navarro claimed that in her considerable experience, she had never been witness to a presence so imposing. In fact, she struggled with even keeping her breath upon entering the house. She reported, quote, "A constantly shifting energy, erratic, like a jealous child throwing a tantrum." She bowed out after just 2 days, informing Hagen as she left the property that he should stay away from the home until serious intervention could be conducted. The residence has been vacant since that day. So what happened on that fateful afternoon? How were 3 phone calls placed to emergency services from a home empty of life for months? From a telephone covered with months of undisturbed dust? Was this a classically tragic tale of a grieving mother who slowly died of a broken heart? Or could this have been the result of something even darker? Is there a chance that, in the pit of unmitigated despair she found herself in, this grief-stricken mother manifested into reality some dark, energetic version of her lost child? We may never understand what happened that day, but we do know that, regardless of what directly caused her death, the last 5 years of her life were marred by a level of psychological brutality that no one should ever face. a tragic and mysterious end to the otherwise happy and productive life of Olivia Maybell.
Welcome, campers, to Campfire Tales of the Strange and Unsettling. We're your hosts. I'm Ryan.
And I'm Jordan.
And now, the debrief. This is a weird one. Is that like that it's definitely different than our normal ghost encounters?
Absolutely.
Like poltergeist, anything like that. I mean, it's very far from anything we normally do, which we may say that sometimes. I actually say that a lot. Like, this is something way different. All right. No, but I really like, especially with this one, it's not even a mystery.
Yeah.
Because there's way more to it.
Yes.
I mean, pointing out immediately, which I will brush on, but like the fact that she's been there, she has this letter dated for that day that the police found her. She's obviously been dead for 2 months. You know, like little things like that, like, you know, they really set this aside from the norm that we normally cover. So,
yeah, I mean, it's certainly odd. Right.
Right.
And I think the official story was that she had like post-dated some of the letters.
Mm-hmm.
But
how do you post-date letters? So I guess this is where I really have a question, because how do you like post-date and anticipate specifically on this date that her body's going to be found, these letters are going to be found, but also these random calls to the police station, to 911, on this particular date as well?
Yeah, that's a big one.
If she's been dead for over 2 months.
Yeah. See, my main problem with the idea of them being post-dated is no letters were found that were dated for the future. You know what I mean? Like, how would she know to stop on the day she's discovered?
Exactly. Unless
she
was in cahoots with somebody that was also on the outside.
Oh, yeah.
Like, maybe the husband, he was actually a part of it, and he claimed that he never heard anything from her or whatever. But secretly had been.
Maybe he made the calls.
Maybe.
But they were traced to that house and there was no evidence of anyone else being there.
Right. Maybe he disconnected the phone. He had an actual normal phone, because it said like even the dust on the phone was unsettled, or not untouched rather.
Right.
You know, hadn't been even brushed on or you know, messed with or anything. So, like, maybe he connected the phone line, used it, and then disconnected it and left.
Yeah. See, I hadn't thought of that, but if someone else, even if it wasn't the husband, if anyone
else
had placed the call, it is kind of odd for a 3,000-square-foot home, even in 1994, to only have one telephone.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
I think so, too. And I'm sure
he could have easily
at least another connection or something somewhere.
Yeah, so if someone else was there and made the call, they could have easily just disconnected the phone from like the kitchen, you know what I mean, and taken it with them.
Yeah, because on a phone cord, I mean, the phone cord is not going to develop as much dust, first of all, as like the actual phone itself.
Sure.
But regardless, that's not even what like this brought about or was discussed. It was the fact that like this single phone line hadn't been touched. So I guess that's my thing. Like, I find it really hard to just believe or maybe fathom that this was all done on this single line. Like, there had to have been something else at play. But I mean, I don't, you know, we talk about like hauntings and stuff like that all the time. Whether this was a specific tulpa that caused all this activity. I don't know any that's going to take the time to call the police, but you know, that's going to be a new type of thing as well. That's one of my biggest thing is, where did this call come from? Obviously it came from the house.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, I just think that there's something else that could explain that.
Yeah. I'm, I guess my question is, though, like, it would make more sense if it was, like, someone else in the house making the call if she had been killed that day. You know what I mean? Like, maybe someone came in and killed her and then placed the calls and then took the phone with them. Like, that was the only thing they touched, so they just unplugged it and brought it with them. But, like, she died months before.
Or maybe... she was writing all these letters that were, she was dating, right? She was dating ahead of time. And the last one that she wrote before she died was this one dated on this specific date. And let's say the husband or somebody else that happened to get into the house found it. So they decided on that date they would go ahead and call the police. You know, just to match up with the timeline as far as the letter.
That seems so odd, though.
Right, exactly. Like, it does. I know.
I mean, far be it from me to assume anyone's motives, but, like, I would assume that if you, like, go to visit your, you know, grieved ex-wife and you find her dead in the house, you probably just call the police and say, hey, my wife is dead in this
house.
But
at the same time, like, what if, like, it became a thing where he started reading all these things, started to see, like, all of these, like, how much his wife, we'll say the ex-husband for a moment, started to see like how much she had invested into trying to develop this thing or trying to communicate with the lost son,
right?
Where it became a thing where he started to invest time into it.
Okay,
maybe he started to bring in fresh flowers, fresh candles, like. You know, he started to, like, after she had died, maybe he didn't want to dispose of the body. He didn't want to do anything. Like, it was his way of, like, trying to carry off where his wife had left. Maybe he was trying to, like, contact with her and the son. You know, like, it's hard to say. We don't know. But,
you know, I didn't do any digging into, like, corroborating his whereabouts during that last couple months.
That would be good to know. Right, exactly.
Supposedly he had moved to Boston, so...
Okay.
I mean, not to say he couldn't have come back, right?
Right.
Like, I kind of like that idea of him showing up and, like, realizing what she'd been doing and, like, maybe she was onto something and he, like, picks up where she leaves off.
Yeah, maybe, you know, his way of leaving things behind, like, finally caught up with them. And he tried to go back, and then by that time, she was already dead. And, but, like, he found all these things and found this shrine and everything. And, like, all this information or whatever she was trying to, like, achieve, if she was trying to basically manifest a tulpa. And then he tries to do the same thing. Basically bringing his family back together.
Yeah. See, because the more supernatural angle to this would be that she accomplished creating this tulpa.
Right, yeah.
And the tulpa was basically built of her grief and pain, and that would have created a negative entity, right?
Yeah.
Because all the energy that it's built from is negative energy, right?
But that's where, like, part of my confusion kind of comes from, though. Is we talk about tulpas a lot and the ability to manifest something specifically from nothing. If you give it that much credibility and focus on it that much and, like, really put everything you have into creating this thing or talking about it or manifesting it or whatever else, right?
Yeah.
And so... I guess my question or the conflict I have with that is, it's creating this negative thing that's building up. Why would it wait till this specific day that this letter is specifically post-dated or dated for, call the police, like, you know, all these little things that I wouldn't expect to happen from that.
I mean, even farther be it from me to assume the motivations of a tulpa.
Right, yeah. But,
right.
You know, that's...
Yeah,
that's
you're right, though. It's weird.
It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. I mean, we talk about tulpas often in, like, the psychosocial version of it. Like, we talk about, like, the Poplik monster being a tulpa because of the impact it has on the world.
Right. Basically believing in something and so much that it becomes a thing because of how much it's brought up.
That it affects the world whether it exists materially or not.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And that's often how we reference tulpas. But in this case, we're talking about, like, a tulpa that gains so much strength, it literally exists on the material plane.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it becomes a physical thing at that point.
Yeah, a physical entity. Yeah. And I have some stories for you about tulpas over the years.
Yeah. That, like, maybe that'll help kind of bring to light more of this, more of, like, what we're experiencing here.
Yeah, so I'll just tell you a little bit about, like, the history of tulpas. After we go through some tulpa talk, we'll come back around because there are some more points about this specific case that we should get to.
All right.
So, like, first of all, with tulpas, it's a lot of people just have this modern idea that is developed about tulpas, but it's important to understand that it, as a concept, it was basically hijacked from Tibetan Buddhism, right? That's where it originates,
right? Which is what we would was kind of talked about briefly in the story, just the origin a little bit.
Yeah. So like turn of the century, like turn of the 19th century, the theosophists from that time period, like, what's her name? Madame Blavatsky. Those like spiritualists of that era of like the early 1900s, they kind of hijacked it and turned the idea of a tulpa into like a boogeyman, you know, like that you could turn things.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah. But like, and that whole movement is huge, like the theosophist movement. It's basically responsible for, like, everything that we consider, like, a lot of parts of what we do now, of the things we cover.
Yeah.
Like, everything from, like, Ouija boards and tarot and seances and, like, right up to, like, Western Buddhism and, like, the New Age stuff, like yoga and meditation and all that stuff. All that stuff is, like, it branches out from that original movement.
Okay.
Like, basically, their idea was to take, their whole goal was to, like, find the link between or make sense of spiritualism and science together. So they were doing these, like, seances with, like, they were the first, like, ghost hunters, basically.
Okay,
they
were,
like, doing seances with, like, these weird little gadgets in the room and, like, measuring things while they were doing seances and doing tarot readings and all,
like, almost like a modern day, like, paranormal investigation.
Sure.
Yeah.
But, like, they were pulling a lot of concepts from like Eastern mysticism. And basically, like, molding it to fit their goals. And the idea of the tulpa was one of those things. Okay, so there's this woman. She was like the first person who really wrote about tulpas in the West. Her name was Alexandra David Neal. And she was like a world traveler.
All right.
Back in like the early 1900s. She wrote like $30. She wrote like 30 books on Eastern mysticism and like documenting her travels around the world.
That's pretty incredible for sure.
Yeah, it's pretty, she has a pretty awesome life. Like, her story is pretty gnarly. But she actually, in one of her books, she actually spoke with the Dalai Lama about tulpas.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. Like, I actually had a conversation with him.
A crazy conversation for sure.
Yeah. So I actually have a quote from the Dalai Lama about tulpas.
Nice.
Okay. So he says, a bodhisattva, which is a being who's attained like a high degree of spiritual enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So a bodhisattva is the basis of countless magic forms. By the power generated in a state of perfect concentration of mind, he may at one and the same time show a phantom, or tulpa, of himself in thousands or millions of worlds. He may create not only human forms, but any forms he chooses, even those of inanimate objects like hills, enclosures, houses, forests, roads, bridges, etc. He may produce atmospheric phenomenon as well as the thirst-quenching beverage of immortality. And then in the book it says, the latter expression I've been advised to take in both literal and symbolic sense. So, like, he's basically describing the Buddha, the legend of the Buddha. So, like, when you talk about llamas, they're basically, like, they're considered a reincarnation of the previous Dalai Lama.
Okay.
Right? But they're simultaneously considered to be a material manifestation of the Buddha himself.
Right. I mean, it takes someone right. that's, like, extremely heightened
yes.
mentally, physically, spiritually
yeah.
in that sense, right?
So, like, a lot of people who point to, like, oh, tulpas are just stolen and misunderstood from Buddhism, they'll say, like, the Dalai Lama is a tulpa in actual Buddhist tradition.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's not exactly true because he is a tulpa, but he's something else. They consider him a tulpa because he's a material manifestation of the spirit of the Buddha.
Right. That's a
right?
physical, yeah.
Right.
Like a physical representation.
Yes. But there's a lot more to it than that.
Okay. Right?
And obviously I'm a white guy in Indiana and I don't know, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, yeah, for sure.
I'd love to actually speak with someone who really knows about
yeah.
it. Right. Who's like really deep into it. But like, that's what I gather is it's way more complicated than just like it was stolen and it's completely misunderstood.
I've never studied like Buddhism or anything. You know, every bit of knowledge I have is just kind of general like things that I've learned over
yeah.
the years. But like that explanation from the Dalai Lama that we're talking about here, mm-hmm. talking about like, you know, these tulpas being basically having like thousands of forms, thousands of
yeah.
representation, things that they can be resented or represented by. Whether yeah. it be, I think you even mentioned like hills or like
yeah.
this or that, like, yeah, I mean, I think honestly, that's something to definitely take note of.
Yeah.
Because when we talk about tulpas, generalizing them, we talk about them as a specific form, like you mentioned with the goat man, you know, like it being
yeah.
such a like widespread thing that like eventually like, you know, these things that people talk about, like whether they be boogeymen, whether they be, you know, people that don't believe in ghosts and like people talking about ghosts being like, that could be specifically like a tulpa if you want to
yeah.
consider it as such, just because of the way that people like talk about it and like bring them to life, because they
yeah.
are bringing life into these things, specifically
yeah.
like manifesting them from nothing to something.
Yeah.
So that's where like seeing them represented or even like imagining them represented as like hills, mounds, like mountains or like
yeah.
valleys or whatever else. I mean, why not, you know?
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, it kind of changes the way that I perceive
yeah.
tulpas in a sense.
See, that was in reference to like tulpas of the highest order, right?
Right,
like the most
yeah.
powerful, the like basically he was talking about like the state of tulpa that can be reached by like a bodhisattva, by like someone who's
yeah, that's spiritually
super,
enlightened.
Yes, yeah, super spiritually enlightened, like
yeah.
the top tier of enlightenment. So basically the lower level version of this that existed within Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, was more often described as like something you could create a copy of yourself.
Okay.
Right? So, like, in this first story that she documents in her book, actually, and I'll put the link in the bio for the book, and it's fantastic. Like, I couldn't stop reading it. But this first account is, it's very much that, where, yeah, I'll just read it to you. It's fairly short.
Yeah, because I have a couple of questions for sure.
Yeah, it's called The Servant Wangdu. So, a young Tibetan who was in my service went to see his family. I had granted him 3 weeks leave, after which he was to purchase a food supply, engage porters to carry the loads across the hills, and come back to the caravan. This is as she was traveling through India.
Okay.
Most likely the fellow had a good time with his people. 2 months elapsed and still he did not return. I thought he had definitely left me. Then I saw him one night in a dream. He arrived at my place, clad in a somewhat unusual fashion, wearing a sun hat of foreign shape. He had never worn such a hat. The next morning, one of my servants came to me in haste. Wangdu has come back, he told me. I have just seen him down the hill. The coincidence was strange. I went out of my room to look at the traveler. The place where I stood dominated a valley. I distinctly saw Wangdu. He was dressed exactly as I had seen him in my dream. He was alone and walking slowly up the path that wound up the hill slope. I remarked that he had no luggage with him, and the servant who was next to me answered, Wangdu has walked ahead. The load carriers must be following. We both continued to observe the man. He reached a small chorten, which apparently I looked up is like a stone pillar.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So he reached a small chorten, walked behind it, and did not reappear. The base of this chorten was a cube built in stone, less than 3 feet high, and from its needle-shaped top to the ground, the small monument was no more than 7 feet high. There was no cavity in it. Moreover, the chorten was completely isolated. There were neither houses, nor trees, nor undulations, nor anything that could provide a hiding in the vicinity. My servant and I believed that Wangdu was resting for a while under the shade of the chorten. But as time went by without his reappearing, I inspected the ground around the monument with my field glasses, but discovered no one. Very much puzzled, I sent two of my servants to search for the boy. I followed their movements with the glasses, but no trace was to be found of Wangdu nor of anyone else. The same day, a little before dusk, the young man appeared in the valley with his caravan. He wore the very same dress and the foreign sun hat, which I had seen in my dream and in the morning vision. Without giving him or the load carriers time to speak with my servants and hear about the phenomenon, I immediately questioned them. From their answers, I learned that all of them had spent the previous night in a place too far distant from my dwelling for anyone to reach the latter in the morning. It was also clearly stated that Wangdu had continually walked with the party. During the following weeks, I was able to verify the accuracy of the men's declarations by inquiring about the time of the caravan's departure, at the few last stages where the porters were changed. It was proved that they had all spoken the truth and had left the last stage together with Wangdu, as they said. So basically, this guy, imagining arriving at the woman's caravan, had the ideas that he had created a tulpa of himself arriving there, right?
Yeah.
And so much so that she saw it not only in her dreams, but in reality, she and another servant saw him walking up the path, this tulpa of him arriving, you know, like bringing to fruition this thought that he was so focused on.
Yeah. Even after they had watched him basically disappear into this monument or whatever it was, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought that was a super cool. It's also a really interesting. This is
really
like,
weird.
Yeah. This is what you often hear about in tulpa stories from this time period. It's like someone is so focused on a goal that that a phantom basically of themselves accomplishes it, right? It's the whole concept of like visualization, right?
That's what like brings me to question, and it's going to be completely off topic, and I know it's a whole other type of topic, But, like, the fact that, like, you can essentially manifest a tulpa of oneself, is that almost the basis where we get doppelgangers?
See, it could be. And these go hand in hand sometimes, especially once the idea is taken over by theosophists in the late 1800s, they start to get blended. So you hear stories like back last October, we covered the story William Williams. You remember that one?
I'm struggling right now. We did.
By Edgar Allan Poe, his story, William Williams. Yep. Okay, about the doppelganger.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, those concepts, because the doppelganger was a really heavy theme in darker literature of the late 1800s.
I mean, his doppelgangers are often seen as something copies. Altogether dark as well, right?
Yes, yeah. So I think maybe that blending with the concept of a tulpa might be what's responsible for it sort of becoming a boogeyman.
Yeah.
You know, a darker concept
once
theosophists got a hold of it. Because guys like Edgar Allan Poe and H.P. Lovecraft, they had like a huge influence on the theosophist movement.
Of course, yeah. I mean, that's where a lot of their writings and things kind of came, like, originated from, like, you know, the basis of that kind of started from. But yeah,
just a lot of those dark concepts. I kind of think of it the same way that, like, sci-fi of the 20th century has influenced the growth of technology, right?
Of course.
Like, you have, like, Jules Verne writing about submarines, like, 50 years before they're invented.
Yeah.
Right? It, like, inspires the invention of
technology.
It's almost
like the idea of it, and then it's like, okay, well, you know, this... It theoretically could be possible, so why not like try it out,
explore it? I have another for you.
All right, yeah, let's hear it.
Ready?
Okay,
this one is called The Painter.
Okay,
so a Tibetan painter, a fervent worshiper of the wrathful deities, who took a particular delight in drawing their terrible forms, came one afternoon to pay me a visit. So this is a guy who painted, like, evil monsters from mythology.
Which, again, reminds me of H.P. Lovecraft's, you know...
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Also, like, all of you who listen to this show who are, like, cryptid artists, be careful. Because God knows what you're creating on accident.
Right.
By drawing your, like, 45th Dogman portrait. Be careful. Okay. To resume. I noticed behind him the somewhat nebulous shape of one of the fantastic beings which often appeared in his paintings. I made a startled gesture, and the astonished artist took a step towards me, asking what was the matter. I noticed that the phantom did not follow him, and quickly, thrusting my visitor aside, I walked to the apparition with one arm outstretched in front of me. My hand reached the foggy form. It felt as if touching a soft object whose substance gave way under the slight push, and the vision vanished. The painter confessed in answer to my questions that he had been performing a dubthab rite during the last few weeks, calling on the deity whose form I had dimly perceived, and that very day he had worked the whole morning on a painting of the same deity. In fact, the Tibetan's thoughts were entirely concentrated on the deity whose help he wished to secure for a rather mischievous undertaking. So a dubthab is like a magic rite, or like a conjuration, basically.
Yeah.
That is like, it's used for like good and bad in their theology. The guy spends the whole morning painting this monster, this deity, and focused on it. He even performs a rite to try and summon it, right? To help him. And then as he's approaching her, she and he sees it.
Yeah.
Behind him.
So as he's trying to, like, summon it, as he's creating it, is it more for, like, creative energy that he's trying to put into it? That he doesn't realize he's actually manifesting something physical?
Man, I'm not sure, because in their belief system, you would perform one of these dubthabs, these rites,
to try and gain, like, it sort of reminds me of in, like, in Greek mythology, the way sailors, before they set sail, they would, like, spend hours praying to Poseidon.
Yeah.
For, like, for help and guidance during their trip.
Of course.
It's sort of like that. Yeah. Right. So, like, she said he had some mischievous undertaking coming up. Okay. He was about to get into some shit, and he thought he needed some help. Jeez. So he performed this ritual to try to, like, gain the favor of this deity. Yeah. And accidentally tulped the thing.
Unleashed it, basically. Right, and right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But again, it's just like, it's just a thought form. As soon as she touches it, it vanishes. It dissolves in front of her. Like, it's literally just a physical embodiment of his focus, of his concentration. Right.
Which, you know, a lot of this, like, a lot of things we can manifest, whether it be some ideal, some idea, something specific, like, say you draw whatever it is, I mean, you know, anything, right? And, like, this is where dreams come into play. And this is where I think a lot of this may stem from, too, is it's something that's invoked basically from dreaming. Because in dreams, like, you can create anything, especially if it's something that you've, like, put all this focus into that does become something physical, even if it's just temporary for your mind to grasp what's essentially been created. And that's where I think a lot of these do stem from.
Yeah.
It might not have been some physical, real, like, real time thing that was, like, evident or whatever else, but something that may have stirred from, you know, like I said, just in dreaming it up or something like that. Like, I mean, obviously, you know, I don't know. I'm just hearing the story back and everything and just kind of giving my two cents. But yeah, I think with anything, I think it's 100% possible to create and manifest something physical. But like I said, and a lot of it is going to be within your own head, though, at the same time still.
Right. Yeah. And that's where the line blurs, right? So, like, that's where you really see the difference between the idea of, like, the psychosocial tulpa, where the idea just becomes so prevalent that it begins, you know, affecting the world as much, if not more, than it would if it were a physical being.
Right.
Right? The line between that and this older and more, like, esoteric idea of it actually becoming a physical entity on this plane of existence, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's where it's, like I said, it's more so, I guess, just depending, I guess, situational. But
I mean, the thing is, like, the big question here is, like, how much of reality is perception, right?
Exactly.
So if you get into, like, the collective unconscious, if enough of the collective unconscious is focused on a concept, then is that a powerful enough catalyst, I guess, to make it physically manifest in reality, right? That's the whole concept. I have one more story I wanted to talk to you.
All right.
And tell you about.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, she kind of became obsessed with this idea while she was there, this author. And this, well, yeah. And she decided that she was going to create her own tulpa.
Okay.
Right. So she chose for her experiment, like, the plainest thing she could. She chose, like, what she chose was, quote, a monk, short and fat, of an innocent and jolly type. So it's basically this, like, Friar Tuck type character.
Okay.
Not even like a Tibetan monk, like a Western monk, right? This is another quote from her about the process. She said, "I shut myself in psalms," which is a period of seclusion, "and proceeded to perform the prescribed concentration of thought and other rites. After a few months, the phantom monk was formed. His form grew gradually fixed and lifelike looking. He became a kind of guest, living in my apartment. I then broke my seclusion and started for a tour with my servants in tents. So if you read the whole story, basically she just locks herself up and she spends all of her time, no matter what she's doing, she imagines this monk alongside her, you know, sweeping the room or, you know, putting away dishes or whatever she's imagining him doing. But she imagines he's there with her all day long.
Okay.
Right? And according to her, eventually it got to the point where she could physically see him. Like, and I don't know how much of that is like where your imagination begins to take over.
See,
right?
That's what I think. I mean, I think just like with anything and just like with people, as an example, like, you know, being in the dark, you think about something so much of like what could be lurking, you know, in the shadows or in the darkness or whatever else, that you start to see things that really aren't actually present, but because you've allowed your mind to kind of play these tricks on you because of it.
Right.
And that's where I think a lot of this also comes from.
Yeah, for sure. She, after she leaves seclusion, she keeps seeing the monk, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, she said it got to the point where she no longer felt like she even needed to think about him to make him appear, that he was just there all the time, right?
So it's always still, even if she's not thinking about it, it's unconsciously in her mind.
Yeah. Especially after months of seclusion, imagining this monk, right? She said that over time, the monk's appearance changed, that he got thinner and more mischievous looking. And his actions started to match the appearance. Like, she would start to see him, like, doing things, you know, mischievous things.
Okay.
Right? And she felt like she was losing control of him, of the tulpa.
Yeah.
At one point, a guy comes to visit her and he supposedly sees the monk sitting next to her in her tent. And he like addresses him before he even addresses her.
Huh. Okay.
And like at that point she freaked out.
At that point, was that guy actually really there?
Right.
Yeah.
That's the question, mm-hmm. right? Like eventually it freaked, because that moment right there, it freaked her out. And she said that she had to, quote, dissolve the phantom. And she said it took 6 months of hard struggle to get rid of him.
Yeah, because she spent so long manifesting this and building it up from nothing to create something that's with her. And it's, I mean, like, you know, you a lot of you see a lot of like horror movies and stuff like this where like you. Think about like whether it be like some long lost twin that like died in the womb or something.
Sure.
You know, like as an example. And then you start to see them later in life or whatever else. Because like you develop like this mindset, you know, you've thought about it for so long that it becomes something that even like in your mind you start to see, and that starts to become part of reality because, you know, you spend so much time developing this. And so it would be really hard to get rid of something like that, though.
Yeah,
it's almost absolutely. It's like it's a habit, right? It's a habit that's been formed at that point. That's basically like been ingrained in this like this thought process and everything. That's where like I do question the idea of it, even though I know it's entirely possible. It's clearly possible.
Right.
And this is a prime example of that. You know, looking at it that way, like you think about something for so long that you develop this, even if it's not real or physical, you're seeing it as something real and physical.
Yeah.
As just like you and I are, because you've created it. I think that's where the whole like idea of, you know, tulpas really like really comes through.
And that's, you know, that, and that concept calls to question, like, where is the line between imagination and reality?
At that point, there's a very fine line. It's almost like a dissolved line at that point.
Yeah.
Like, as you mentioned, like that guy seeing this person or seeing this thing that she created. What if he wasn't really there?
Right.
And it was her essentially, like, you know, manifesting.
Seeing,
like,
someone see him.
Right. Like, being visited by someone else. Like, maybe, like, that's how fine she grew that line to be.
Sure.
And, you know, which I don't think is a stretch, you know?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'll reference people who explore psychedelic drugs.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, mm-hmm. the things that those people experience during trips, you know, they often come back with these, like, messages of, like, you know, that help them in life. These messages of, like, we're all connected, and, you know, these things that feel like cat posters now, but, like, they're really, like, deep, meaningful, life-changing mm-hmm. revelations that happen to people while they're tripping. And, like, to me, those experiences aren't any less real.
I agree.
You know what I mean? I agree.
And it's, you know, I've read and, like, heard about stories of people also using psychedelics and things like that, that claim to, like, see, like, long lost relatives and,
yeah,
you know, and also share in experiences because you are essentially, like, in that mind state together, that you can experience these things together. You know, and yeah, just as you said, like, it doesn't make it any less, like, any less credible than a physical experience with you and another person.
I mean, those experiences are a part of their life.
Yeah.
Just like going to the grocery store is, you know what I mean? It's just as material and even more impactful, you know, it's so.
And
there's a whole avenue of exploration to be had there with psychedelics, because there are all these stories of people.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, being able to tap into that, like, extra parts of your brain that aren't used on a normal day-to-day basis as well can create some extremely crazy things.
Yeah. And there's so many stories of people experiencing the same things, you know, like, people who take ayahuasca, they see, like, mm-hmm. this winged serpent, and, like, there's, like, very similar experiences across the board for different, you know what I mean? So there's, like, a whole concept of maybe it is, like, transporting your consciousness to another plane, to a place that really exists.
Right. It could be something that really exists, or it could be something that, like, you've heard about these things happening, and then as you experience it, it's like that mindset's in the back of your mind, like, you know, something else is somebody else is, like, seeing or whatever. Then all of a sudden that becomes, like, a thing. Right. Not even thinking about it, because it's there, it's subconsciously there, right?
Right. Which is the surface level explanation for, or just the tip of the iceberg for the conversation about, like, the collective unconscious, right?
Yeah.
Is, like, you absorb all these thoughts that, you know, all the stimuli from the society you live in, and it shapes your mind, whether it's in the front or the back of your mind, mm-hmm. it's still shaping you, right?
And that's where
it colors your experiences,
and that's where dreams come from,
right?
That same process,
right? Like, you're tapping into it.
Yeah
But anyway, like I said, that's a whole separate
subject. It is but I think it's also fair to bring that to this conversation, even minimally, just because, like, I think that can be part of these things, part of these experiences.
It might be part of what's going on here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one thing this monk story reminded me of was a thing I used to do when I was a kid. So when I would be in the car on, like, on long drives, well, all drives, because, you know, we didn't have, like, iPads or video displays in the backs of headrests or anything.
Right, so, we weren't as fortunate growing up.
Yeah. So what I did to pass the time was I would imagine this ninja, okay, outside the car, that would, like, run alongside the car and, like, run along the, like, telephone wires and, like, jump from thing to thing. And I would imagine that every time we drove somewhere.
Okay.
Right? That, I feel like that ninja was my monk. Like, I was imagining him every day, every time I got in the car. And, like, it really eventually got to the point where, like,
you would just see it, as you were.
Yes.
As you were in
it. It was
that.
Just there, whether,
right.
whether I was like, oh, I'm, it wasn't like I got in the car and I thought, oh, I'll imagine this guy now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was every time I got in the car, I looked out the window and it was there.
Yeah. And that's, I think, where even as you, like, may grow out of something, you know, something so, like, minimal as that, like, just, you know, yeah. seeing this thing, and you're always in this, like, this specific space, this specific mindset, like, whatever else, yep. you're always looking at, you know, you being, especially being, like, a passenger or something else, and you're, like, passing the time that, yeah. like, it brings you back as you're there. You know, yeah. it just gets you back in that headspace, whether you realize it at the point or not.
Yeah.
And so,
yep.
and there you go. You've created that, essentially, a tulpa.
Yeah,
of this,
apparently.
Of this little ninja.
yeah. I believe he was a full-size ninja.
Oh, okay.
I just always saw him from a distance.
Gotcha. I right? didn't know if so he was like a little, like, tiny guy.
No, he was just always up on, like, the telephone wires and stuff.
I was thinking of, like, a squirrel-sized ninja.
Awesome. Okay, so I wanted to talk about a more modern example.
All right, yeah.
of a tulpa, right? Okay, so this is in the 70s, in okay. the 1970s. So way beyond, you know, theosophists have already hijacked the idea of a tulpa. They've already, like, influenced all this occult society. And all this. So there's a guy, Walter Gibson, and a lot of people who listen will know the name. He wrote The Shadow.
Okay.
The pulp novels about The Shadow. It was like a detective superhero type character, right? He wrote 280 novels of The Shadow. Yeah. So, like, this is what I wrote about him. Okay, the word prolific is actually inadequate to explain how much Gibson wrote. He was known to work on multiple stories at once on different typewriters, wandering back and forth as he had the next set of ideas for each story. He would also type until his fingers were swollen and bleeding, and produced an average from 1931 to 1949 of two full Shadow novels a month.
Wow.
Two novels a month.
That's a lot of writing.
Yeah, for 18 years, two novels a month, along with other writing projects related and not. So for many years, he was the sole writer for the entire Shadow magazine, which always included the main Shadow novel and several short stories by differing authors. Like, he would use different pen names to write different columns in his magazine.
So not only is writing
24 novels a year.
24 novels. Yeah, 24 novels a year.
Yeah.
For, you said 18 years?
Yeah.
Good Lord. Okay, so...
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not even going to do the math right now.
Yeah.
That on top of also writing other things, too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Keeping up this, like, monthly magazine that he put out.
That's nuts,
man. Where he used different pen names to write all the columns. Yeah. Prolific.
Yeah.
For sure. But he was also a stage magician. And in his, like, earlier life. So, in the midst of a tangent during an interview in 1975, he said the following. I remember talking to Ed Burkholder. He and I had an apartment together down in the village for a couple of years. That's the apartment that's supposedly haunted now. 12 Gay Street. Hans Holder said it's haunted. People see a man in evening clothes moving in and out. But that was where I wrote The Last Shadow. And what they're seeing is Lamont Cranston. They're seeing what we call an afterimage, psychic projection, not a ghost. So he was convinced that all that focus, all that writing on The Shadow had created this entity.
Yeah.
This version of The Shadow in that house that people now see as, like, an apparition. They, like, it's famously haunted by this shadow creature.
It's actually built and stayed in that location. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Like, I want to cover his story in its entirety for an episode because it's super cool.
Okay.
It's like, his history is awesome. He's like one of those, like, Hemingway era authors where he had these like this wild life that contributed to his writing, you know. But I think this idea is super cool. Like that he spent so many hours thinking about his character that he created him in reality. That's amazing. Jeez. Yeah. And like the most, of course, the most obvious modern example of a tulpa is often cited as being Slender Man.
Yeah. That's, and I guess that would be more, more modernish. Cause of course people have done YouTube videos and written stories and everything else on, right? Yeah. Now it's been even turned into movies. You know, just another one of those creepypasta things. But
Slender Man is split into three camps, right? Because you have people who acknowledge that it's just fiction. It's just creepypasta, right? Spooky spaghetti.
Yeah.
And then you have the people who believe it's an actual ancient being, right? The people who talk about, like, there are cave paintings that look like it and all that, right?
Which could also be aliens.
Probably crazy, but not to pass judgment.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the third camp, of course, is that Slender Man exists, but it's because Slender Man is a tulpa. Mm-hmm. That all this focus on Slender Man on the internet primarily, like, birthed it into the world, basically. Yeah. I think we can agree at least that Slender Man is a tulpa in the same sense that, like, the Popelik monster is a tulpa.
I would agree. I would even say probably more so.
Right, on a bigger scale, yeah. Because it's more popular.
Definitely on a larger scale. Because of, like, mainstream media and things like that.
Well, when 12-year-old girls started stabbing each other over it, it kind of picked up speed in the press.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. There's been a lot of things, like Momo or, you know, all that stuff. Like, a lot of those things that have come out of, like, creepypasta stories that end up turning into something that people buy into.
And they're really affected by it.
And then are affected by it. And Slender Man, I think, has taken that to a whole other level, for sure.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's a great example.
That case in Wisconsin where the 12-year-old girls stabbed their friend like 19 times in order to become a Slender Man proxy was their explanation. That got the most press, but like in that year there were like dozens of incidents where kids primarily were like violent, had these violent outbursts and blamed it on like some devotion to Slender Man.
And was
a case where like a girl burnt her family's house down.
And wasn't it like if you go and now I'm just trying to remember specifically like the whole Slender Man movement. But like if you're like chosen by him, like you go with him and then you essentially like leave everything behind, right? Whatever.
You get to like go live in Slender Man's house in the middle of the forest or whatever. Yeah.
Whatever you want to consider that to be.
Yeah.
But yeah.
It's definitely affected culture, right? Which makes it real.
Yep.
Yeah. I tend to fall into the camp of that, where that's the full extent of it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, for sure.
That like the effect it's had on people is the extent of its existence.
Yeah, it's the mindset that people put themselves into, believing in these things, creating them, manifesting them, like developing them into something quote unquote physical or whatever else because of just that mindset that you're in at the point.
Yeah.
You know,
and ultimately working on its behalf.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, at that point, you're basically doing its bidding. And then the more so you do that, the more real it becomes because you're out there actually doing something for this thing, whether it's real or not. You know, at that point, it's real because you're doing, you know, you're doing something on its behalf, like whether it be for some false purpose. Or whatever it is, you know, you're still doing something physical, something that's in real time for this thing.
In its name.
In its name, exactly. Yeah.
So that is the perfect segue to fully wrap this back around to the story that we started with.
Yeah.
because there are a contingent of people that don't believe this story at all.
Okay.
Okay.
I mean, so, I can see where somebody wouldn't, you know. Yeah. For sure.
So there's some circumstances that you should be aware of. Okay. So other than like a snippet of the coroner's report, and I was able to find that, and I was able to find the death certificate for the son. I could not find a death certificate for the mother, which that's not shocking to me. It's fairly common for a family to like seal those.
Yeah.
Right.
Because I mean, the son was what, 4 years earlier than the mother's death. So
yeah. Also, sealing his would have been up to the parents.
Right.
And she was clearly not in a state where she would have been making like legal decisions. Right. And the dad skipped state. So here's the thing. This story didn't really gain any prominence online until 2015, when a small production company launched a Kickstarter for a movie based on this story called Thoughtform.
Okay.
Okay. Which doesn't necessarily. So the question is like, is this real or is it some kind of viral marketing plan? Right. But either way, the boy died. Right. That's real. That's like a real filed death certificate. He did die.
Right.
That's 100% whether
everything
true.
After the fact was actually true or not.
Right. But we've covered a few stories that have inspired film.
Yeah, of course.
You know, so like to me, that doesn't immediately make me think that this is fake.
Yeah.
Right.
I agree.
There's a solid chance that these guys just, and one of the filmmakers is from this town, actually. So there's a solid chance that he knew this legend, right? This, I mean, it was 20 years.
I guess my first question before you get further into it, were you ever able to find the police report on this specific occurrence?
So not the police report specifically. I was able to find several audio from TV interviews and radio interviews with the now retired police officer who was the first on the scene, who like filed the report.
Okay.
I wasn't able to find the report itself, but I was able to find her talking about the report.
Yeah, because I feel like if we had the actual legit police report, like you could say there's no way that this was faked because this is what happened. This was actually documented at that time by the people that were there, right?
Honestly, before we started recording, when I was telling you, there's a lot of media associated with, like, a lot of photos, which almost makes me question it more. Because it's usually hard to find photos like that that are so relevant.
Basically hardcore evidence, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it kind of makes me feel like even more so that it might have been at least exaggerated. The story may have been exaggerated.
Yeah.
There's a solid chance that the boy died, the mother went into seclusion, and she sat in her house and died of a broken heart.
Yeah.
Basically.
I mean, that's
starved to death.
That's not far fetched. That happens. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And that became legend in this small town, right? And just slowly details got added to it over the years, right?
And turned into
imagine that being the case.
Bedtime stories to keep you up at night, basically. Right.
Right. But my thing is, even if the story is fabricated, like, doesn't that kind of make the story a tulpa? Because like you were just saying before, you know, in your brilliantly accidentally placed segue, like if you're doing something physical in the name of something,
mm-hmm.
like you and I are sitting here right now creating media.
Yeah.
We're like putting something in the real physical world in the name of this story.
Right. We're bringing this to light now.
Right.
Creating something out of it.
In a sense, creating it. Right.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. So I kind of think it doesn't matter if it's real or not.
Yeah. I have to agree with you. And I hate to beat a dead horse at this point and go back and say it's because of how much we talk about it and how much we actually bring it to life. But that's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's like the lesson to be learned, right?
Yeah.
From like this whole conversation is like, and that's kind of the way over the months that we've been doing this show, that's kind of the way I've come to view a lot of these like cryptids and alien encounters is like, it doesn't matter if it's real or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's a part of human history, right? It's a part of, it builds the folklore of humanity.
Yeah. Whether it be culture based or, you know, just some urban legend or whatever else.
Right.
It's what these things are kind of built upon.
Yeah.
And they continue to like give it that much more life.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, we say so often, cryptozoology is a social science.
Right. Yeah. No,
it's not about whether or not there's a real physical thing running around. It's about how it affects society, what role it plays in human life, right? In like, in this existence we all share, it's as real as it would ever need to be.
Yeah, exactly. It's essentially as real as you make it out to be.
Yeah.
And so,
listeners, if you have any input on tulpas, we would love to hear them. Absolutely.
I think it definitely opens up for a wide argument across all spectrums. Because, again, whether it be urban legend, whether it be creepypasta, whether it be some culture-based thing that you've grown up with, I mean, anything.
Yeah.
Like,
whether it be legitimate physical, like, maybe there is, like, let's say Bigfoot. Maybe there is a physical, you know, bipedal giant ape living in the Pacific Northwest, right? You can't tell me at least some of those sightings aren't essentially tulpas.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean,
agreed.
It has to be.
Agreed.
Right? Yeah. Maybe it stems from something physical and real, but Bigfoot in itself, the concept of Bigfoot is so much bigger. It's so much more impactful to the world than just a bipedal ape who lives in the forest.
Right. I mean,
could ever hope to be.
You get stuck in that mindset that this is so real and you believe in this wholeheartedly. You're bound to come across something that's going to give even the slightest bit of evidence.
Yeah.
Because you want it to.
Yeah, of course. And like, hats off to those guys out there trying to physically prove the existence of these cryptids, right? But like, you can't shun the sociological aspects of it. I see this more and more where these people who are into like the hard science of cryptozoology they get upset when people talk about the like the psychosocial phenomenon that goes along with them.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And because they feel like it detracts, or you're saying that thing isn't real.
It takes away from like, it. And
right. But it's so important. It's incredibly important. It's a huge aspect of what they are.
Yeah.
I think the legends that precede them.
You have to be open to realizing like specific things like that. Like, because I think the more you are open to that, the more like it's just going to add to it.
Yeah.
And again, the more life that it brings to it because you are open to it. You're allowing yourself to remain open to it. So like, you know, it's not that thing that's discouraging against it, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Agreed.
So, yeah, I mean, honestly, I don't know. You know, I wish that there was more evidence to this story, that, like, you know, we could be like, yeah, bam, here it is. Like, here's that right. police report. Here's exactly what went down that day. But knowing that original person, quote unquote, like, you know, has been able to, like, talk about these things and, you know, it, recount these things, and we have, like, pictures of, like, this area or whatever else. And yeah. all we have to hold up against is a story.
Yeah.
You know, but a story that I'll buy nonetheless, because I don't think, you know, just even if the fact that it's not 100% physical, I think just the idea of it and everything that it's created, it has created this like presence, this yeah. life that it's built even within the story itself to make it that much yeah. more real.
Agreed.
Excellent.
And that concludes episode 43. The Mysterious Death of Olivia Maybell.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. From the bottom of our weird, possibly alien, maybe ghostly, probably cryptid hearts for listening. We absolutely love having the chance to discuss all these wild creatures and events every week, and it's your continued attention that allows us to carry on.
And if you want more, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/campfire/tales-of-the-strange-and-unsettling. It's there you will find bonus content, behind the scenes, we're just keeping up on our day-to-day, and maybe some swag along the way. It is our way to show thanks for your support and do everything we can to provide you with as much content as possible. Again, that's patreon.com/campfire/tales-of-the-strange-and-unsettling. With that said, we want to get to know each and every one of you, so please come and check us out on all the socials. At campfire.tales.podcast on Instagram and Facebook, at campfire.totsau on Twitter, and you can also visit our website at campfirepodcastnetwork.com. If you love the show, please rate and review it. It's what truly helps us continue bringing your weekly dose of the strange and unsettling. And lastly, we do have our merch store. You can find the link available on all of our social media or via our link tree. Show your support. Buy a shirt, buy a sticker, buy a blanket, buy a pillow, anything that you want to rep Campfire Tales of the Strange and Unsettling.
And a special thanks to Greg Martin at Reverent Music on Instagram, the brilliant mind behind the gorgeous music that you hear each week behind the debrief. So go find him at reverentmusic.bandcamp.com, or you can visit his Spotify page by searching Reverent, R-E-V-E-R-E-N-T. All of these links can be found in the episode description. Go and support him. You both deserve it.
And that's it. Until next time,
I'm Ryan.
I'm Jordan.
And remember, campers,
stay weird.
And trust in the unknown.